and welcome everybody to another episode of the Sanskrit Studies podcast. My name is Antonia Ruppel, and my guest today is Professor Saroja Bhatti. Saroja, if you and I met on a train or a plane and I asked you, so what do you do? What would your answer to me be?
First of all, thank you, Antonia, for giving me this chance to share my views about Sanskrit and also about my own life. My answer to your question is, I am a Sanskritist. I am a teacher of Sanskrit.
And if I then asked you, so what does that involve? Or, well, Sanskrit, what is that? How would you describe it to me as a layperson, as an interested layperson?
Yeah. Sanskrit is one of the ancient languages of the world. It is rich with literature. Basically, it belongs to India, and it is now considered as India's identity. It is a very rich language in terms of literature and also its vocabulary and many other things. And it has many things to contribute also to the science of linguistics. So I think this should be enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So how did you first become interested in Sanskrit?
Actually, impetus to study Sanskrit came from outside. In my early childhood, my father and my uncle, they used to teach me recitation of Sanskrit verses, stotras, etc. So thus, I was introduced to Sanskrit at the age of, say, 4 or 5, without knowing that it was Sanskrit. And I could memorize very fast, and my pronunciation also was very good. So my uncle used to ask me to recite stotras during, you know, social gatherings and family functions. And I got a lot of appreciation. I got accolades, praise, and also gifts. So I started liking Sanskrit. Then in school, Sanskrit was introduced to us in 8th standard. And in all examinations from 8th standard onwards, I always used to be a topper in Sanskrit paper. That added to my liking for Sanskrit. Moreover, I attended courses in Sanskrit organized by a private institute in Pune, where teachers were very good. They created interest for Sanskrit in my mind. So this is how I developed interest in Sanskrit in my school days.
Mm-hmm. And so you said you started by, you know, with recitation of stotras, and then you had Sanskrit in school. What would school classes in Sanskrit, what would they be like? What would you focus
school
on?
Class, yeah, as any other subject, you know, Sanskrit would be taught from the readers from the collections of Sanskrit lessons prepared by different teachers. So we didn't actually read basic Sanskrit texts like Ramayana and Mahabharata, etc. But they were kind of readers or textbooks. And we studied them. And it was kind of a spoon feeding. There wasn't any kind of two-way traffic. The teachers used to dictate translations and notes and everything. And we were supposed to, you know, remember them by heart and reproduce the whole thing in exam papers. Mm-hmm. So that was not really a very good way of learning Sanskrit. I personally did not like it. But there was another institute where I studied Sanskrit, that private institute I'm telling you, where actually I studied Sanskrit with interaction. I used to interact with teachers. I used to ask them questions, and they used to answer with all patience. So that was the difference.
Yeah, that sounds like it makes all the difference.
Yes, and, yes, of course.
And apparently, you did. So the accolades and the success that you mentioned were enough to then keep you with Sanskrit also at the college, at the university level.
Yes, because in my school leaving examination, that is 11th standard, I again was awarded some prizes, etc., particularly in Sanskrit. And, you know, prize means money. And during those days, particularly in a low middle class family from which I come, money really matters. Mm. And therefore, as it happened that I got a scholarship, then I went to the college and I opted for Sanskrit. Of course, the love for Sanskrit was there. But yes, I chose Sanskrit.
And during your time as a Sanskrit student at university, do you remember any courses or any teachers that you particularly liked, that you particularly enjoyed? Could you tell us more about those?
Yes, of course. There was a teacher, one Professor Mayankar, and he used to teach us Meghadutam, which is a very well-known poem by Kalidasa. And he also used to teach us Bhagavad Gita. I think it is a well-known text. But, you know, he always used to make teaching a delight. And we always used to feel that his lecture should never come to an end. And that again added, you know, to my love for Sanskrit.
And was there anything that even back then as a student you thought, this could be different, this could be better? I was having higher hopes for this.
Not really at that time. It came a little later. What happened at the postgraduate level, I had to make a choice of Sanskrit subject. Either I could go for grammar, or I could go for literature, or I could go for something else. And the same thing was there in the other institute where I was learning. So I had an excellent teacher of grammar. There was another teacher who was teaching philosophy or Vedanta. First, I opted for Vedanta because I thought that it is good to learn philosophy. And when I started taking lessons from him, you know, I developed a dislike for Vedanta. I'm sorry to say. But then I decided not to learn Vedanta in my life. So that was a kind of, you know, hatred I developed. But that is, you know, mainly because of the teacher. And then once I switched over to grammar, then I never changed my specialization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you say resonates with me and also with a lot of the people that I've talked to, because, you know, the quality of a teacher just is so important. And that's basically what draws a student in more than the material itself, because the student gets to know the material through the teacher.
Yes, exactly.
And so then you started focusing on grammar. What in your particular context does that mean?
Sorry, I couldn't get your question.
Oh, apologies. So when you said you focused on grammar, what in your context, what does that mean? So Sanskrit grammar, how would you have studied Sanskrit grammar? What would you be looking at? Perspectives would you be taking and so on?
Yes. First of all, you know, I started with just primary grammar as it was taught in schools. And even in the other institute, it was the same thing. But then the texts were being introduced when I started it as a special subject. And when the text was being introduced, there were two methods of studying the text. One was a modern method. And the modern method consisted of translation into English of the text, explanation. And if it is about grammar, then you have to also give examples and also derive that particular word. Because grammar, particularly Panini's Sanskrit grammar, is a very well-known text. It is the first, the oldest, and the most perfect grammar of Sanskrit. So, it has its orientation in derivative process. So in order to understand the derivative process, the teacher is supposed to explain the whole process. In the modern method, this whole process was not really explained in detail. But in the traditional method, it was, and I always preferred to go by traditional method. And perhaps maybe I have some liking for mathematics. I loved that process. And this is how I started studying grammar. I did not just depend upon the classroom lectures which were being delivered in the university. But I started learning with a teacher of grammar who was in that other institute. And to be very honest with you, I studied in the traditional method with more depth and more profound approach.
And can I ask, what was that other institute that you've now mentioned several times?
That institute is in Pune. It is called Tilak Maharashtra Vidyapeeth. Mm-hmm. And the name of the teacher who taught me is Pandit Vaman Shastri Bhagavat. He was a hardcore linguist. He wrote on the Vakyapadiya Brahmakanda with translation and notes. Unfortunately, that is in Marathi, and therefore only Marathi reader can read the book. Marathi student can read the book. But he was very thorough in technical method, traditional method of studying. And he was a patient teacher. He used to answer all our questions. And that was very important. Mm.
And when you said, so at some point you started reading, you know, the actual texts. So apart from Panini, apart from the Ashtadhyayi, what other texts would you be studying?
For post-graduation, there were quite a few other texts also. Even for graduation, as I told you, we studied Meghadutam and Bhagavad Gita. So similarly, dramas of Kalidasa, then dramas of, you know, Vishakhadatta, many other complete texts of Sanskrit dramas, then also poetry from Kalidasa, Raghuvamsham, then dramas of Bhasa, and poetry also from Shishupala Vadham, Kiratarjuniam, which are very well-known Sanskrit, they call it epics. Mm-hmm. And also the great epics, Ramayana and Mahabharata. So selections, of course, not the whole text, but the selections. So actually it was a very wide range of, you know, texts, and also some portions from Veda. And there was a reader from text from selection from Brahmanas and Upanishads also. So, you know, various texts we read. Mm-hmm. And I had opted also for a Pali as my subordinate subject. Mm-hmm. So some texts also from Pali I had to study. So I read those texts also.
You also mentioned, so when you were studying, you know, grammar specifically, that, you know, there were classroom lectures, but then you also studied, you know, the actual grammatical texts. So I was wondering, were those texts, you know, was this something in addition to the Ashtadhyayi? Did you study other grammatical texts as well? Or was the focus solely on Panini?
It was a Paninian school, actually, because mm-hmm. Paninian school, you know, is actually the basis of the whole Sanskrit grammatical system, the tradition. So I studied different texts, but all those texts again belong to Paninian school. Mm. For instance, there is a text called Paribhashendu Shekhara. So that text contains rules of interpreting the text of the Ashtadhyayi again. Mm-hmm. But it is a different text. And then there were several commentaries. But I hardly studied grammars belonging to other systems. I did study Chandra Vyakarana and Katantra Vyakarana and other grammatical systems. Because, you know, non-Paninian grammatical systems are quite a few. Yes. In the whole grammatical tradition of Sanskrit. I did study them. But only when I wanted to compare Panini with them at research level, mm-hmm. for my PhD research. Till then, I focused mainly on Paninian school. Apart from Ashtadhyayi, I read texts like Paribhashendu Shekhara, and then there is another text called Paramalagu Manjusha. So texts on semantics also I read.
And you just mentioned your PhD. So what was that on?
My topic for PhD was again on Panini. And the exact title of the topic is Pre-Paninian Grammatical Elements in Panini's Ashtadhyayi.
Which is such a wonderful topic. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? So what did you find? What did you think was the most interesting thing that you found?
Actually, it was not really very interesting, but it was interesting for me. It was already
That's what
known
matters.
to my seniors. What interested me was that, well, Ashtadhyayi is not a creation of Panini. It is not composed by Panini. Basically, it is a compilation because Panini owes a lot to his predecessors. And nearly 50% of the technical terms which Panini uses, they are found in the literature which precede Panini. Of course, Panini has himself also created new terms for his own system. But even then, Panini is very highly indebted to his predecessors, not only for technical terminology, but also for grammatical technique. This is what I found. But again, what I found was that the beauty of Panini's grammar lies in the fact that he so beautifully brought the whole data which he collected from his predecessors. He so beautifully brought it together and he gave it a complete original new appearance. And he refined it to such an extent that it was a totally new creation.
And
this was very much interesting for me, and I really enjoyed it.
And if, say, you were trying to convince a publisher, to say this book was, say your research was unpublished, and you tried to convince a publisher to publish it, what would you say would be the main sort of takeaway points? What would be the
First
reasons
of all,
why it should
I,
be published?
I would have told him that this is the first of its kind. Because when I took up this subject, I took this subject on the advice of my teacher, my senior teacher. You know, during those days, it was the teacher who used to suggest the topic to the student. So this is how it happened. And he, my teacher told me that nobody has worked on this topic to such an extent. There are a few articles, but an exhaustive study of the technical terminology doesn't exist. So the first thing I would tell the publisher is that this is the first contribution of its kind. Secondly, it contains an exhaustive material on the topic with which it deals, and therefore it can serve as a basic study aid. Thirdly, those who want to study Sanskrit grammar, of which Panini's system is the base, is at the center, for them, it is very necessary to study these basic technical terminology. It actually forms the very soul of Panini's system, Panini's grammar. And therefore, it is a very important work for all students of Sanskrit grammar, not only Panini, but also other systems, because they also draw upon Panini. These are the two basic things I will have to say.
If I was a publisher, you'd have just convinced me.
Thank you.
And so you did your PhD research, and what came after that? You know, for some people, it's a very smooth way into an academic career. Other people, need to wait a little longer until they get proper employment. How did things work out for you?
You know, I must tell you that I have been lucky throughout my life.
Good.
I should say, because I had godfathers as if, waiting for me at every turn of my life. So as soon as I got my PhD, first thing I must tell you that I actually entered into the field of research, particularly PhD, mainly because I was offered a fellowship. And, fellowship means money again. And money was, again, a very important thing for us during that time. So, And then, again, I got an opportunity, again, to earn money after I submitted my PhD thesis. And there was an opening of senior research fellowship in the same university from which I did my PhD, that is University of Pune. And as soon as the post came up, it was advertised, I applied. And yes, luckily, my result was out. I was you know, awarded a doctorate, and that was the qualification for that. And you know, during that period, the contestants also used to be very few, so there wasn't any, you know, a tight competition neck to neck like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a senior fellowship, and then came another position of research associateship, and then finally I bypassed the position of lecturer, and I straight away was appointed a reader in the university. And from reader also, it wasn't very difficult for me to become the professor and head of the department, because during that time, you know, it was, of course, it was a very hard time for me, because I had to work very hard to make my publications, to attend seminars, to get exposure, and to, you know, prove myself as an able candidate for any further higher post.
Mm-hmm.
So I, of course, did that. I did a lot of, you know, I took a lot of efforts. I read, I studied with other teachers, with my, you know, fellow researchers, and I got myself trained with all full efforts, and then I got the professorship. Along with professorship came the position also of the head of the department. So my journey was in a way smooth, you can say, but it was a hard earned journey, I should say, because it was not an easy task for me to show myself as a deserving candidate, mm-hmm, for any of these posts. So it was, on the one hand, it was hard because, mainly because, you know, at the time of doing my PhD, or after completing my PhD, I realized that it was a total failure. I really did not do justice to the topic. Mm-hmm. I'm not much happy with my PhD dissertation. I realized my shortcomings, and then I deliberately tried to overcome them by learning other languages. You know, like I knew a little German, but I did not know French, and I had not read much of even Western researchers. So I put a lot of effort in reading those works, and this is how, you know, I tried to enrich myself with all knowledge that was available, and this is how you can say the journey was both smooth but also hard.
Well, you made it as smooth as you could by doing all this hard work, and by basically working strategically. You know, sometimes people only do work when they have to, and other people look ahead and say that, well, you know, if I do this work now, that is going to profit me in the future, and that's what you did.
Actually, you know, by that time, you know, after I finished my PhD, I had really developed a liking for research. That, mm-hmm, is one thing. Secondly, my teachers, my seniors, they always used to involve me in their own projects. And I decided not to say no to anyone. So they used to come and ask me, would you help me in reading these texts? Would you help me getting those references? And shall we read together? And this book, this is a German book, and we need to read together and translate it for my own project, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a very good training for me, and I can say that yes, I started developing liking for all these research activities. It was innate, and also because of my seniors.
Yes. If I may ask, to what extent did the fact that you're a woman affect your career? Was that ever a disadvantage? Did that not play a role? Was it ever an advantage, perhaps?
Honestly, yes. Great disadvantage, I should say. Being a very, very traditional Hindu housewife, I had to face many difficulties. Because I have to look after the house. I mean, during those days, there wasn't this concept of husband sharing the work with the wife. It was hardly there. So I was always told by my seniors, even from my parents' side, my mother and father also, when I got married, they told me that don't forget that career comes at the second place. You are first a housewife. So that always was there. And all responsibilities I had to shoulder, household responsibilities, right from shopping, marketing, and, grocery and all that, up to cooking and everything. So that was one thing. Secondly, you know, there are always constraints when you have children.
Yes.
I have just one son, but when he was born, then another responsibility fell upon me. Thirdly, with slight displeasure and some very bitter taste in my mouth, I have to disclose this because it is being on the podcast, but people should know that if you are a woman and if you are being promoted to a higher post, there are always competitors, particularly men, who don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
It is true. It is true. I must tell that it is true. And when a woman becomes an administrator, there are at least a few men who try to say that she is a failure.
Yes.
So I had to face all these problems. But somehow, by God's grace, maybe, or by maybe...
And your very hard work and persistence.
By my own nature, yes. I overcame all these difficulties and I proved that I am a very successful administrator. Now I can say so.
Yes. Thank you for saying that so openly, because this is just something that, you know, people need to hear. Just imagine if... Because of your sex, because of your gender, you had been prevented from doing the research that you did, I think the field would be a lot poorer. And there are many women who, are prevented by their gender from not just academic careers, but generally, you know, professional work outside of the household.
Also outside India, you mean? India also?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I would say probably pretty much any country any time period that I know a little bit about.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
That seems
very peculiar to India.
No. My feeling is that it's very international because, of course, you know, there are always cultural differences, but then we're all humans, and some things I think sort of supra-cultural, so that they're not dependent on what culture you were brought up in, or what often sort of important part of culture would be the various religions, the faith systems, you can use pretty much any system of thought, whether it's faith-based or not, to argue that there is a reason why women should stay, you know, at the in the kitchen. So I'm very grateful to you for persisting and for doing all the hard work that you did. Could I ask, so you mentioned that, obviously you had, it's clear that you had great, great, great talent and great dedication to your work. But you mentioned that, money, so real life factors played a role. If money had not played a role, what would you have become?
Perhaps my parents would have married me off to a gentleman and I would have been a housewife. I don't think I would have done anything else, to be very, very frank. Our fate was always in the hands of our parents, I belong to a middle-class family, and that was, in during the 70s and even before that. 1970s, that was the period. So usually our parents would think of marrying us even before graduation. So I am really thankful to my parents that they allowed me, but they had already started looking a match for me.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was doing my graduation. Luckily, nobody liked me.
Well, there's lots of advantages to being a difficult woman in pretty much any culture.
But let me tell you that as I was continuing my studies in PhD, they found a match for me, and that my would-be husband, he finally approved me as his would-be wife. And then I had to get married before I completed my PhD. And I wouldn't say, no, I don't want to, because I want to first finish my PhD. No, that was not actually the case, because we were not allowed to say no. Somehow, you know, they told me that now here is a person who has approved you, and you cannot say no, because you will not get another chance like this.
Right.
This,
yes.
You know, this practice of love marriage was just, you know, making its beginning in India at that time.
Mm.
So it was in my case, it was an arranged marriage, and my parents decided. So, okay, I said, all right.
Well, I'm glad that in spite of all of this, you were able to continue with your work.
Because of the support of my husband, of course. My husband, yes. I'm very much thankful to him. Because he, after my marriage, he told me, I asked him, which is the thing in me that you liked. So he said, your love for academics. And I want my wife to be an academician. So he always was very kind and very supportive to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I owe all my, you know, career to my husband, basically.
Well, I know what you mean when you say that, but obviously, you know, you owe your career to so much of your own work. But of course, that you were able to do your own work was made possible by your husband. So I share your feeling of gratitude. But coming back to your work, you've you know, published a lot over the years. What was your favorite piece of work that you've ever done?
I have done quite a few works with my own guru, Professor H.D. Joshi. I really enjoyed working on Fundamentals of Ashtadhyayi with him. That was the book I enjoyed. And secondly, the other book is on Tadditas. Mm-hmm. Taddita suffixes in Panini's grammar. So that particular part of Ashtadhyayi, which Panini's grammar, which deals with secondary suffixes and secondary derivatives. These are the two books I really enjoyed working on.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more to, you know, for everyone in our audience who, you know, is aware of Panini in theory, but doesn't quite understand, you know, how his grammar is ordered, what it means, you know, for it to involve algorithms, derivations, and so on. So could you, for example, say a little bit more about what, you know, secondary derivation means, you know, what taddita suffixes are?
Yes. Should I give you an example?
Yes,
please. I don't know how far they will understand this example from Sanskrit. I really don't know, but assuming that all the audience, they know a little bit of Sanskrit. So the name of the person is Dasharatha. Perhaps the audience is aware that Dasharatha is a name of the father of the famous Lord Rama, who is very famous because of this Ayodhya thing. And I think everyone all over the world is aware of who Rama was by this time. So he was father of Rama. His name was Dasharatha. So if you want to say son of Dasharatha, you can make a secondary derivative from the very word Dasharatha by just adding a suffix e to that, and it becomes Dasharathi. So when Dasharatha becomes Dasharathi, the meaning changes from just Dasharatha, a person, to the son of the person. So this is a secondary derivative. So when you derive a particular word from a noun with an additional meaning, it becomes a secondary derivative. And here we have a patronymic. Dasharatha's son becomes Dasharathi. So such kind of derivatives, I really don't understand right now. I don't remember right now any word from English. Perhaps if you can remember, you can give an example. But there must be patronymics in other languages. languages also.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the in Germanic languages, you've got the one where you just add son, but that's not a derivative. Yes. In Greek, you would have suffixes like ides. So I'm just thinking, yeah. If you're talking about where do we have an English example? Wonderful. Now, of course, you know, you give a beautiful example, and I'm completely blanking. I'm sort of thinking, you know.
Actually, yes, yeah. I can say the word is kind, and we have the derived word kindness. That is also a secondary derivative.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, I was just trying to think of a patronymic, but yes. So for kindness, entertainment. Would that be? No, I think that would be primary.
Yes. Yes.
Well, it depends. Yeah. I mean, entertain is a verbal basis. So
in that case, it won't be a secondary.
Exactly. Yes. So I'm just, you know, floundering horribly here, and all my credibility as a Sanskrit teacher is going down the drain. But we've got you, so. Well, I have very good news for you, which is just that you've just won the entirely wonderful, but unfortunately also entirely fictional, Sanskrit Studies Podcast Research Grant. Which gives you the opportunity to focus on any vaguely Sanskrit-related research area for several years, alone or together with others. First of all, mm-hmm. congratulations. Second of all, what are you going to use this wonderful grant for?
Thank you very much. And yes, there are quite a few areas where I can use this grant, but related to Sanskrit, of course. For instance, there are two methods of studying Sanskrit in India. Traditional and modern, and they are still, being followed. Traditional learning continues still in pathshalas and a few Sanskrit universities, whereas modern method is followed in other institutes and other universities. Traditional method focuses more on texts. It goes deeper into the texts. It is not concerned with current research. It is not concerned with new discoveries, whereas modern method consists in looking at the text in different perspectives with different approaches, comparative, historical, etc. So, and I can go on explaining many more things about the peculiarities of both these methods. But let me come to the point. Both the methods, they have their pluses and minuses. So, and that I have been observing it since I started learning both, traditional and modern ways. So I always felt the need to bring these two methods, which are very parallel, these two streams on one platform to establish a dialogue so that there will be a kind of a give and take, and knowledge in Sanskrit will not remain stagnant. You know, what happens in Pathshalas today is that they always feel that the last person in a particular school, in a particular system, whatever he says, with that, the whole knowledge comes to an end. So it is not anything beyond that. And in Pathshalas, they just revolve around those texts. So there is no new thought coming up. For instance, in Paninian system, Panini's grammar, the last person who really contributed to the theory of grammar and to the thought is Nagoji Bhatta, belonging to the late 16th century. After that, we don't find any substantial contribution in terms of thought, in terms of theories in the field of grammar. As far as the traditional learning method is concerned, they focus on these texts. And they go on and on, just reading those texts line by line, word by word, and study them. But they never think of whether what they teach is correct or not. They never challenge their concepts. It is other way around in the modern method. So if you bring the traditional pundits on the same platform with the modern scholars, again, coming back to Panini's school, because it is my own field of grammar. my field of specialization. I can give an example, like, you know, there are very good scholars like George Cardona and Paul Kiparsky in the West, who have very, very substantially contributed and have made very original contributions to the study of Pandini. But the whole, you know, traditional community of grammarians, they are completely unaware of it, and they are not willing also to accept what they see. So if we bring them together and establish a kind of a dialogue, perhaps I think they will realize that, yes, this is the approach we should take towards studying, say, Pandini's grammar, or maybe Nyaya text, or maybe Mimamsa. And we should critically look at those texts. And if we critically study those texts, perhaps maybe some new thought will arise. So contribution to the different shastras by giving new thought is what is lacking in traditional systems. So this is what I want to happen by bringing the traditional pandits with a dialogue to the with the modern scholars. So this is the project I would like to take up. Actually, some efforts were done earlier also, but they did not continue. But I think it will certainly take forward the sciences in Sanskrit, for instance, the disciplines in Sanskrit, the knowledge systems in Sanskrit, which are, you know, which has stopped at a particular point right now. After 18th century, there is no further progress in those systems. So if they have to progress, they must be brought forward in dialogue with modern scholars. They should be given new insights, new approaches. This is my feeling. And I think it will take a lot of time. So my podcast research grant, perhaps you will have to extend it further.
I would be absolutely delighted to extend it as much as you need it, because this is so extremely worthwhile what you're suggesting. There are all sorts of people who expend energy, you know, in very serious, methodical, strenuous ways. And if these energies could be pooled, if they could be combined, that I think would be of advantage for both sides, for everyone.
I think so. Yeah.
Thank you. I very much hope that you know, someone who listens to this podcast might say, well, maybe I can't achieve, you know, the ultimate goal that you just described, but I can do a little bit to for all of us to get closer to that goal. So that would be my wish here. So I just asked you about basically, you know, what you would ideally want to do if you had, you know, all the time and all the means there in relation to Sanskrit. But let's say, you know, the goddess of time came to you and said, you know, you have the opportunity to do anything that you would like, to learn any skill that you would like, maybe learn another language, get into another discipline. If this happened to you, What would you choose?
Actually, you know, since my childhood, during my childhood, I wanted to be a dancer because I used to like dance very much. And I used to participate in extracurricular activities more than in academics. I was hardly interested in academics, but I was more interested in dance, drama, music, etc., etc. So if an opportunity is given to me, maybe I would like to learn these arts, dance, music, etc. And also among other languages, at present I have developed a very strong liking for Urdu because I like Urdu Shairi very much. I like Urdu ghazals, and I feel that the language is very, very sweet. So rather than learning any Western or even Far Eastern language, I would love to study Urdu. And lately, I must tell you that I have realized that I am more suited for a job involving social contacts, social activities, social work, say working in places like, you know, old homes, you may laugh at me, or orphanages, even pets' homes. I'm more suited for such things. I like all these things, you know, working with people.
Yeah.
And not working in an ivory tower. So actually, research was never my cup of tea, though I developed a liking for it. I always wanted to be with people, help them, be of any use to them, and also benefit from them both ways.
Well, you know, no, I'm not laughing at you at all when you say this, because I understand it very well, and it's and there's always this conflict I find in academia. You know, we need people who basically spend their life just deeply buried somewhere in an ivory tower, but then academia absolutely needs people who can then take this, you know, ivory tower produced knowledge and you know, use it to affect the world with it and maybe change the world with it. So we need both. And when you're a person who is, you know, obviously very, very skilled at research, but also cares deeply about lots of other things, that's always very, very difficult because there's only so many hours in the day.
Yeah, I know.
But so you had, you know, the career that you outlined from, you know, research associate to reader to professor. I was wondering from your perspective, what about the system of academia, perhaps specifically to Sanskrit or to grammar or to philology, what do you think works well and what would you like to see changed?
Honestly, it really doesn't work well because the products are not good. I'm talking about India. I'm not really much aware of what is happening in the West. But as far as India is concerned, you know, I have many opportunities to visit different universities and also to have interaction with students. And what I have found is that they don't even have a sufficient bookish knowledge. So the way they are taught needs to be drastically changed. So the first thing I would always recommend is to train the teachers. We have to train our teachers, and we have to train them very hard. We have to train them in reading the text, also in reading beyond the text, and to make a very pleasant, you know, classroom lecture, to make it a very delightful experience. So everything, you know, we have to teach to the first to the teachers, and then it goes down to the, because looking back at my life, what I see is that I am what I am because of my gurus. I am a product of gurus. So if I had not made those gurus at every, you know, turn of my life, perhaps I would not have been what I am today. So, you know, a lot of the development of a student depends upon the teachers. The first of all, the teachers have to be trained, and it has to be made mandatory actually for every teacher to thoroughly study the text. Nowadays, what I find in even in the universities is that the teacher doesn't go well prepared to the class. I was told that there are some teachers who don't take classes for weeks together, for months together. And if somebody asks them why, they say, oh, there are not enough students in the class. Out of 5 students, I find only 1 or 2. Why should I go and teach? This is not the proper answer.
No.
But this is a reality, I'm telling you. This is reality. So it needs to be changed. So, you know, I'm very much distressed with the present situation of Sanskrit studies in general. Well, there are some rays of hopes, of course. There are some good teachers and some good students, but they are, you know, far and few. So what we need urgently to be taken up is to, you know, train the teachers in such a way that students really develop love for the subject and they try to go beyond exam-oriented approach. They study the language, they study Sanskrit or any other subject for that matter, only to get good marks.
Mm.
Not beyond that. So if you ask them afterwards, please quote me a beautiful verse from the Megharutam, they will not be able to say anything. They have never learned it by heart. They have never tried to appreciate the beauty of Kalidasa's poetry, say, for instance. So the teachers have to take them to the deeper level and to show them the beauty, where lies the beauty and where does it not lie, of a particular thought, of a particular concept in a particular text. So in order to understand all these things, the first of all, the teacher must read the text thoroughly, must study it very hard, and also use all these methods, comparative method and historical method and all such things. And, you know, all the during these days, what I have observed very, closely is that our students, particularly in India, and that also I'm talking about North Belt, North India, they read only Hindi texts. They don't want to read English books. So how can their research be complete without reading any research that is published in English or any other language? When I was doing my PhD, my guide told me I must learn German and French. But that is not the case. They don't even want to read English. So you have to encourage. It is the duty of the teacher, first of all, to read English books and English research. And then make them read more. Even beyond textbooks, they don't want to read it. So developing a liking for reading also is actually the duty of the teacher. Mm-hmm. And for that purpose, he himself has to develop that within himself.
Yes, so, be a...
I can go and go on and on with many more things I can say, but this is the essence.
Thank you. Yes, and it's funny that you say, you know, you're commenting on the situation in India, but for example, in English-speaking countries, the situation is exactly the same. So when many students in the UK and in the US are some are unwilling to read things that are not written in English, but it's also an issue of, again, of money and of class, because usually the opportunities to learn languages are given to those who have some free time, you know, whose parents have the money to get them into the kinds of schools that teach foreign language as well. And so it's something that is to some extent it is not the student's fault, but to some extent it's also the fact that all of us need to change our attitudes towards language learning. And, we don't necessarily need to aim at complete mastery, but we need to aim at being able to read texts, written texts, in lots of different languages.
Having said that, I would still like to say one more thing, and that is love or liking for a particular subject has to come from within.
Yes.
So if you really don't like Sanskrit at all, if you don't like languages, and if you like mathematics, there is no point in making you study Sanskrit.
Would you have liked to become a mathematician?
Once upon a time, yes. Because, I was good in... I'm talking about myself in very high terms. But yes, I was very good at all subjects, and I used to get very good marks in mathematics and science and many other subjects also. I was a topper, at that time, I did not know what to do. But yes, perhaps had I really got a good teacher in mathematics and had he persuaded me to take up mathematics, I would have done it, I think.
Yeah, again, the enormous importance of good teachers. Yes. I was wondering, even though you have many, many interests, let me just come back to the question of the field of Sanskrit. If there was someone who whether in India or maybe also outside India, was interested in studying Sanskrit in, you know, whatever way. So focusing on literature, focusing on philosophy, focusing on grammar, so on the systematic study of the language. Is there any kind of introductory text, or maybe even, given that you say, you know, the interest has to come from inside, so any kind of novel or a TV program or anything like that that you could recommend to them that would maybe fan their interest?
I don't believe in any media and TV programs, because whatever little I have watched quite a few times, it is all misleading. It takes you to on very different. So on the contrary, I would rather recommend don't just trust on what you watch on television or what is presented on the media. Because sometimes, you know, it is biased.
Mm-hmm.
Often it is biased, I should say.
So would you perhaps suggest...
These are not really a good aids in, you know, making you study. I personally don't believe in these things. I personally don't watch also. I'm sorry. I'm a useless person in that case.
No. This is a very important perspective to have. Would you perhaps suggest, reading, you know, just going back to the original texts and maybe reading them in translation? Or, I don't know, this is perhaps a very sort of Western-based question, because, you know, in India, Sanskrit kind of is all around you, and it's very easy to get to find out about the existence of Sanskrit, which, you know, I didn't do until I was 19, for example. So maybe in an Indian context, this question is superfluous, because, you know, if you just watch your surroundings, you will find out that there is a lot that you can study, and a lot of beauty and a lot of history and so on. But So maybe I will simply take back that question, or maybe perhaps rephrase it. If you find someone who is interested, who is thinking of, you know, studying Sanskrit at the college, at the university level, and then maybe embarking on a career as an academic or as a researcher, what advice would you give to them?
Oh, what advice would I give to them? Well, he has to read extensively. He has to focus not only on that particular research area or on that particular text, but he also has to read other texts, other areas, because they are, you know, all mixed with each other. So, for instance, if you want to read Panini, you just cannot go on with studying Sanskrit grammar, but also you have to study Mimamsa and Nyaya and other disciplines, because they share certain things with each other. And as I said right now, you should also try to understand what other scholars say about it. Say scholars from different countries, maybe what is written in French and German and other languages also is very becomes very helpful. So enrich yourself, update yourself with all that is available. Do not just confine yourself to the discipline or to the text which you want to study. You know, when I just give you my example, when I was doing my PhD in Panini, I was not aware that there is a science called linguistics in the West. And then it was my teacher who told me that, look, here is a department of linguistics and there is a teacher who is giving introductory lectures on linguistics. Go and attend it. If you... attend the classes in linguistics, you will have an idea about what is happening in the West in the same field which belongs to Panini. And then you can compare and then you can find out whether Panini has really contributed something more, or the Western thought on linguistics, they have something more to understand Panini, or some such things. So this kind of, comparative approach, all these students, the new students, they also have to develop. This is my feeling. And discussions with your fellow students, they are always very helpful. Participating in different research activities. Not only that, I always encourage my students to take up courses in many other fields, like, manuscriptology, which are related, but not exactly the areas in which they are working. Manuscriptology, and then there is, symbolic logic, which is the classes were going on in the Department of Mathematics. But I encourage my students to go over there. Symbolic logic has something to do with even Paninian system. So you have to keep your eyes open and look around and find out what is happening where.
And with this very comprehensive advice, not just for students, but I think also for teachers, you say students should look out for certain things. And I think this implies also that, teachers should be making sure that we offer these things for our students. With that, I would like to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. Professor Saroja Bharti, it's been a delight having you on the Sanskrit Studies podcast.
Thank you very much, Antonia. I'm really grateful to you for giving me this opportunity because I shared some of my views which I never shared earlier. Thank you. Thank you again.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
Nice talking to you.